The Asian Classics Institute presents What the Buddha Really Meant with Geshe Michael Roach, recorded live in New York City in November of 1998. This is the beginning of Class 6.
Last time we covered the three turnings of the wheel because that's what the mind-only school takes the opportunity. That's what they use to decide whether the Buddha was teaching something figuratively or literally. Okay, so, you know, they're interested in the three turnings of the wheel because that's an easy way to divide everything into what Lord Buddha taught literally and what Lord Buddha taught figuratively. So they're very interested in what were the three turnings of the wheel and what did he speak about and are we to take it on face value or not and things like that. They have the sutra in which the Buddha explains the intention of all his other sutras, which is the main mind-only sutra, right? Which is the whole thing we've had so far. All of those questions by the Bodhisattva, the answer by the Buddha, the decisions that are made after that exchange, those all come from this famous sutra. And in fact, the one chapter called the chapter spoken at the request of the Bodhisattva, Yambapat, or what's his name, Paramattha Samudgata. Okay, so they're very interested in this question, and that sutra is talking about this question: what are the three turnings of the wheel? Okay, there's the first one, the second one, and the third one. So I'll debate with you now. Okay, do we decide the three turnings of the wheel, the order, or what's in the three turnings of the wheel, by their historical order? You see what I mean? Do we decide it like that? You know, you say no. Okay. So, Patricia, wow, we don't call them the first and second and third turnings of the wheel.
No,
we do, right? We call them first, middle, and final turnings of the wheel, right? So we do divide them by time.
Call them
yeah, you can say, good. Not necessarily so. Okay. Yeah, just because they're called first, second, and third turning of the wheel doesn't mean that they are defined by historical circumstances, okay? So does that mean that the Buddha didn't teach the first turning of the wheel first?
No.
No, he did, okay? And you'll get... Today you have a very interesting reading. Before we went to India to get teachings on this so that I would know what I was talking about, I started to translate the monastic textbook on this subject, which is very, very detailed and very difficult. It's all in debate, dialectic. And I did about 25 pages in Australia or something. And then in the cars, right? And then when we got to India, he says, I'm not teaching that book. You know, so he taught the original book by Jetsun Khapa, which is extremely difficult, okay? So then I noticed that today's reading was exactly the subject of the first 25 pages of the debate manual. So to save myself about 20 hours, I just stuck it on at the end. Okay, so that's why your reading is like 20, 40 pages or something, okay? So you're going to get there. The whole, I thought it'd be interesting and fun for you, sadist, you know, to look at the way that a monastic textbook would present the same information. So you have the information presented by Jetsun Kapa in his very deep way, Manjushri's deep way, and then you have a huge section in which they debate it, okay? And they debate these questions, okay? So in there you get this question, you know, was it by time? They say, no, not only by time. So we don't call it first, second, third, turning wheel? Yeah, we do, okay? Well, so it doesn't relate to the time, right? And then you say, no, it does, but that's not the only criterion, okay? It is true that the Buddha, 49 days after he pretended to become enlightened, says the text, because he was enlightened before, supposedly. Supposed to be, okay? It is, okay? 49 days after that, he taught the teaching on the four Arya truths. And then only after that, much later, the year following, it says, he started to teach the teaching on emptiness, okay? And Vulture speaks. It's interesting that you get some dating in the monastic textbook that you don't get by Jetsun Kapa. And then you get a lot of interesting details about the three turnings of the wheel. Okay, so how about if I show you this one? Did everything the Buddha said during the initial period of his teaching career, you know, in the first year, say, before he got to Vulture's Peak, right? Before he started the Prajnaparamita Sutra stuff, okay? Is everything he said the first turning of the wheel?
No.
You gotta say no.
No.
Okay? You gotta say no. And what's an example? Well, that's on your homework, so I gotta write it down, okay? Where's that? This is a very, very famous example in the study of Chang'e. You know, Chang'e is what you're studying. When did the Buddha mean what he said, and when did he not mean what he said? Okay. This quotation is very famous. Say, Goyogo Mare. Goyogo Mare. What's that mean? It's a joke in a Tibetan class in the monastery. They say, you know, you don't have to carve it. You could just write it. You know? All right. Okay. Say ngade, la, shantap, dumur, kor, chao, she. Okay. Ngade is a famous expression. Nga means five. Like the great fifth Dalai Lama is called Ngaba Chenpo. Okay. Nga means five. Ngade means the group of five. And this refers to the first five disciples of Lord Buddha. Okay, they were five ascetics who were hanging out with him when he got enlightened. Okay, and as you know, and we were trying to figure out who in this class was here at the beginning of these classes in 1984. And I think Robin's the only one. And we read this sutra. It's the Sutra of the Tiger. It's from Serudam Bedo, the Golden Light Sutra. And we read that whole section of the sutra. That was the first thing we ever did here. And it tells the story of Lord Buddha in a past life giving his body to a tigress and to her cubs who he prays should become his students when he becomes a Buddha. And they actually become the first five disciples later. And that's called Ngade, those five, first five disciples. Buddha taught the four Arya truths to them, repeated it three times. Kaudinya, the main disciple, I'm curious about which one he was, mom or the cubs, one of the cubs. But anyway, he achieved the path of seeing immediately afterwards. Okay, he saw emptiness directly. So Ngade means those five. Shamtap means the lower part of a monk's or a nun's robes. Okay, this is a shamtap. Okay. Dumbur means, it can mean circular, like a skirt. Okay. I've heard it also, this passage, glossed in the monastery as neatly or, you know, nicely, okay? Literally it means a round skirt. But I've heard it also explained in the monastery that this is instructions. Goar chao means you should wear, don't forget to wear, okay? So this is a famous sutra at the very beginning of the Buddha's career, Lord Buddha's career, where he's advising the first five. You know, and he says, don't forget, you guys have to wear a nice, neat lower robes, okay, that circle around your body, you know, that wrap your lower body. Okay, that's one of the first teachings he ever gave after the Four Arya Truths. Okay, I mean, if you say, what was the second thing Lord Buddha ever taught, or you know, like that, it was teaching them how to wear their robes. Okay, She means thus did he speak. Okay, She. Okay, that thing at the end, She. This is very often quoted in this subject that you're studying. Why? They say, is this one of the first things the Lord Buddha taught? Yeah, it is. It's like, I don't know, second thing come out of his mouth. So is it the first turning of the wheel? Say no, not in this school. Okay. And by the way, never forget this point. We have to distinguish between the first turning of the wheel in general and the first turning of the wheel that we is talking about when we're talking about the mind only's favorite sutra. Okay? In this sutra, according to this sutra, how it defines the three turnings of the wheel, this statement is or is not the first turning of the wheel. It's not. Okay? Oh, so he didn't teach it first? Yeah, he did teach it first. No, he did teach it first. He taught it, you know, a couple of days after he got, you know, met the first five. Okay, but is it the first turning of the wheel? No. Why not? Be careful. In the monastery, too. Be careful. Why not? Why isn't it the first turning of the wheel?
Deal with the four Arya truths.
He says it doesn't deal directly with the four Arya truths. That's a pretty good answer. But there's a better one. I'm asking you, with regard to this mind-only sutra, why would they say, we don't care, we're not worried about that statement. Okay. She says because you can take it literally. Not exactly. Okay. That's one way to answer it. The main thing is that, I'll ask you this, is the Bodhisattva deathly concerned with this statement? You know, is this what we are going to sweat about? You know, did the Buddha mean it or not? You know, I mean, see, that's in this school, you have to get used to that. In the mind-only school, is this the first turning of the wheel? Are we sweating over things exist by definition or not when the Buddha says, hey guys, don't forget to wear your robes? Okay? No. Okay? So is it the first turning of the wheel for the mind-only school? No. Not really. I mean, you could say it was taught early on in the Buddha's career. It's a nice thing to say. But it's not what we are tearing apart the universe to find out, do things exist by definition or not? It's not what the Bodhisattva was sweating bullets over when he asked his question to Lord Buddha. Therefore, it doesn't qualify as part of the first turning of the wheel in this school. Okay? Huh?
What is it?
It's a sutra by Lord Buddha. No? Okay? Right? But, by the way, is it a sutra because it's written down somewhere? No. Sutra meaning ka. Okay? The speech of Lord Buddha. Okay. Yeah. The open speech of Lord Buddha. Okay? Right. Or maybe not. We'll see. Okay. Okay. Second turning of the wheel. So, if there was a sutra that Lord Buddha spoke during the middle part of his teaching career, and if it doesn't make some statement like, nothing exists by definition, nothing has any reality, nothing exists truly, nothing exists from its own side, if it doesn't say that, even though it was spoken during the second period of the wheel, second period of his teaching, would it be considered the second turning of the wheel in this school from the point of view of this sutra, especially from the point of view of the Drupden? What's Drupden? You had it last week. Drupden is the conclusion of the transaction, right? What's the conclusion of the transaction? What transaction? The exchange between the Bodhisattva and Lord Buddha. The Bodhisattva comes out to Lord Buddha and says, first turning of the wheel, you said everything exists by definition, or you kind of implied that. Second turning of the wheel, you said nothing existed by definition. What did you mean when you said that? Okay, that's his question. Lord Buddha comes back and says, hey, would I say everything existed by definition? No. Would I say nothing existed by definition? No, I'm not crazy. We got to divide things. The third turning of the wheel is called Lepache Wechungkor, the wheel in which we divide things. You know, we divide these. Oh, I did mean it about those things. They do exist by definition. I didn't mean it about those other things. They don't exist by definition. Okay? Like that. He says, those blanket statements don't work. What I really meant was two different things. Okay? I had two different things in mind when I did that. Yeah?
Why would the Buddha go from the first turning of the wheel to the second when
I love the question, okay? They always sprinkle a bodhisattva to ask questions in class, okay? Like, okay, I'll jump ahead, okay, since you asked. He said, you know, why would Lord Buddha do the simplest presentation first, the most profound presentation second, and then backtrack in the third? Why doesn't he just shift the order? Well, guess what? There's a sutra that says that's what he did. And I'll give you the name of it. You just got them home 15 minutes earlier. They should give you a medal. Okay. Say, Sungya ki do. Sungya ki do. Sung is a difficult word. It's similar to the word for mantra, ngat. Okay? Sung is a very similar word to ngat, meaning mantra. I believe it's dharani. Okay? And sung means like mystic words. You can translate it as mystic words or something like that. Okay? Gyalpo means king. And do means sutra. This sutra is called the king of mystic words. The sutra called the king of mystic words. Okay? King of mystic words sounds sexy. It has nothing to do with that. It's a guy named king of mystic words or something like that. And he requests the sutra. So don't get, you know... Don't peek in it hoping to find some mystic words. That's just somebody's name, okay? In this sutra, they say, you know, the real order of the three turnings of the wheel should have been... Say, Denshi, Chungkor. Denshi, Chungkor. Den means truth, right? Shi means four. Chungkor means turning of the wheel of the Dharma. They say, let's put that number one. Is that anything different from the mind only? Is that anything different from this sutra's presentation? No. What is this sutra? What do I mean when I say this sutra? The sutra in which the Buddha explains his other sutras. Remember? It's called the Commentary on the True Intent of Mahayana Sutras. It's actually autobiographical. I mean, commentary sounds like somebody else wrote it, right? The Commentary on What the Buddha Really Meant. Written by the Buddha. Okay? All right, you got to get used to that. I used to search through the 10-gear catalogs. This is 3,500 books looking for this commentary. It's not in there. It's in the other one. You know? Okay, it's not a commentary by anybody else. It's an auto commentary. Okay, Lord Buddha is explaining what he meant in all his other sutras. Okay, that sutra says that this one should be first. By the way, that's the mind-only school's favorite sutra, right? Now, the King of Mystic Words sutra, does it also say this is first? Yes. By the way, King of Mystic Words is going to say the order of the sutra should be by profundity or by correctness. Okay? Okay, here's the second one. According to that second sutra now. Okay? Kogomare. Say Lekpar. Chewe. Chungkor. Lekpar. Chewe. Chungkor. Lekpa Chewa means make fine distinctions. Fine distinctions, correct distinctions. Between what? Distinctions between what? Literal and figurative, okay? I did mean that, I didn't mean that. And more specifically, these things do exist by definition and these things don't exist by definition. And when I said they all don't exist by definition, I was just pulling. When I said none of them existed by definition, I was just kidding. Okay? You have to Lekpa Chewa. Okay? That's the... You have to divide. Some things do, some things don't. Constructs don't exist by definition. Pens do exist by definition. And so does third attribute, emptiness. Okay? Okay? Yongdu. Okay? That's, I mean, that's how he would say it. Yeah? That's Lekpa Chewa. Now we've made good distinctions. Okay, Chungkor, turning of the wheel of the Dharma. Okay, now the King of Mystic Words, that sutra says, let's put that as number two in response to your question. They knew you wanted to do it, so they did it that way. Okay, they moved it from number three to number two because it's less correct. Okay, and why cause a problem? You know. Why not save the big stuff for the last, right? You know, denouement. Why not have a big finale? You know, First you tell them everything exists by definition. Then you tell them some stuff does and some stuff doesn't. And then when they're ready, you pop it on them. Hey, guess what? Nothing exists by definition, okay? That means you would put this one number 3. And Lindsay keeps trying to object here. I mean, I don't know if you're hearing that, but we'll get to that. She keeps saying, well, wait a minute. Try to imagine what she's trying to object to. Say, Tseni, Mebe, Chunkor. Tseni, Mebe, Chunkor. Tseni Meba means nothing exists by definition. Tseni Meba means nothing exists by definition. Chungor means the turning of the wheel of the Dhamma, where Lord Buddha said, nothing exists by definition. The King of Mystic Words Sutra says, let's move it to number 3, because it's the most correct. You know? So now we got a very natural, you know, progression. First you tell them, hey, everything's suffering, you can get out of it, don't worry, everything's cool. And it all exists by definition. And then later on you say, by the way, I was just being figurative. You guys should understand that some things are what this thing we call emptiness, and they don't exist by definition. Although, of course, some things like pants exist by definition. Anybody can see that, okay? They're made in a factory and everything like that, okay? And then finally, when they're mature enough, you pop on them the third turning of the wheel. Guess what? This doesn't exist by definition either. It doesn't have its own identity from its own side. Okay, you pop it on them. Last. Wouldn't that be a nice progression? Least correct, half correct, totally correct. She says, for whom? Okay, good question, you see? Not for mind only. Okay, mind only would say, are you crazy? You know, when he said nothing exists by definition, that's when he was half right. Okay. And then later he got to the real truth, which is that this exists by definition, but my idea of this or that doesn't. Okay? Right? So for them, the order should have been the old way. Okay? The old way. What? Not much correct, halfway correct, totally correct. Okay? Who do you think, what of the four great Indian schools likes the King of Mystic Words Sutra? Majjhimika, they like it that way. Okay, that's all. You got to get used to that. You slipped into Majjhimika. I told you couldn't go into that door. Okay, you got to stay in mind only in this class, right? The Lama in Sarah, where we learned it, he kept beating us up every time we slipped into Majjhimika. He says, "Don't think like Majjhimika." Okay, if you're mind only school, the order has to be four truths. Then. Nothing exists by definition, and then you make fine distinctions. Okay? In increasing correctness. And it's only the smartest disciples who could take the last one, which happens to be us mind only people. Or is it? Go back to your notes. Who were the disciples for whom each of the three turnings of the wheel were designed? Who was the first turning of the wheel designed for? Huh? Hinayana, okay? Does that mean we're dissing all the people in Sri Lanka and Burma? No, okay? When we say Hinayana, we're referring to a philosophical mindset of anyone who has a certain idea about emptiness, whether they're Tibetan or Burmese or New Yorkers. Okay? You is Hinayana if you think everything is coming from its own side. And since we do most of the day, what's a test? What's a barometer whether you're thinking that way? Do you have a mental affliction? Okay. The worse your day went today, the more Hinayana you were, because you were taking everything as self-existent. Because you cannot get angry at a thing, or upset, or jealous, if you understand a thing's emptiness. Impossible. That's why we study emptiness. Because we want to eliminate mental affliction. Okay? So it's just a mindset. Hinayana mindset. So first turning of the wheel was taught for Hinayana mindset. Who is the second turning of the wheel taught for? She says middle way, she says Mahayana. What do you guys say? What did the sutra say? Mahayana. Tepa chamba la nyang dapa shupe, namba dapa shupe, dulchala. Okay? He taught this for people who had excellently, perfectly entered the Mahayana. Okay? Quote what sutra? Which one would they be quoting here? Mind only school. The commentary on what I meant when I taught all the other sutras, and specifically the chapter requested by this curious bodhisattva. Okay? Now we get to the third turning of the wheel. What did it say was the audience? Huh? So, yeah, it said both, right? In fact, the wording was Tepa Tamjela Yandapa Shupe Tojala, okay, which means for disciples who had excellently or perfectly entered all the yanas. Okay. Now the reason I brought that up is that I'm going this class totally out of order, okay? The reason I brought that up is because it's a good chance to bring it up. The textbook writer for Sarame, the brilliant Kedup Dhammadharma, even more brilliant than his teacher Jatsumba from Sarajay. We improved. We improved on their textbooks, okay? He came up and said, look, what does the sutra mean when it says everybody for the third turning of the wheel? Doesn't it strike you as strange? I mean, didn't it strike you as weird when we talked about it? You know, that somehow the most advanced turning of the wheel, you get to be Hinayana and still hear it? You know, doesn't it seem strange? And he says, it doesn't mean that at all. And I taught it to you wrong that day, okay? You got so it's on your homework now, okay? It says to people of every yana, okay? And Kedup Dhammadharma, in the last page of your reading, the last two pages of your reading, he says, what's he talking about? It wasn't designed for Hinayana people, okay? What's the sutra talking about? And it's very cool. He goes into a very cool thing. He says, you know how you really define the first turning of the wheel? And get this, this is cool. It was the turning of the wheel that was designed for students who could understand how the three attributes applied to the emptiness of a person, as that is, how should we say, as that is, how do you call it? Explained in a version that the kids can understand in the first turning of the wheel. Okay? It's very interesting. You see? As that emptiness is adjusted by Lord Buddha for people who could only hear it in the first turning of the wheel. Meaning people who couldn't get real emptiness. Okay? It's very interesting. So he's defining the first turning of the wheel that way. He's defining the students for the first turning of the wheel. People who could only understand the three attributes with regard to a kind of simplified emptiness that Lord Buddha simplified for them because they couldn't get the real one. Okay? And that's, we say, is the emptiness of a person, which is easier to perceive than the emptiness of other things. Okay? Generally speaking. Okay? So he's like, how do we define the students for the first turning of the wheel? Anybody who could get the simple version of emptiness. Okay? Anybody who could grasp the simple version of emptiness. That makes them Hinayana in this presentation. Okay? That makes them first graders. Okay? First grade Dharma people. Okay? And that's how he describes the first turning of the wheel. It was designed for people who could only get the version of emptiness that Lord Buddha taught during the first turning of the wheel, which is the simple one. Okay? Which one? The emptiness of the self, of the person. Okay? The emptiness of Vilma. The emptiness of Mag. Okay, like that. All right, that's the simple one. How then do you define the people who for whom the second turning of the wheel was designed? Mahayana people. But the kind of Mahayana people who cannot understand the emptiness presented in the second turning of the wheel, unless some bodhisattva comes up and asks some question, and then the Buddha splits it for them. I'm sorry. Is that right? Yeah. Second turning of the wheel. Yeah, you gotta say, who don't need to rely on that. Sorry. Yeah, sorry. Yeah, sorry. These are Madhyamika. Is it don't? Let me check. Yeah, but we're talking mind only score. Yeah, without needing such a division. Okay? So, the disciples for whom the second turning of the wheel was designed are people who can understand the emptiness, the difficult emptiness, which is the emptiness of objects, presented in the second turning of the wheel, without having some bodhisattva come up and try to clarify things. They're smart enough to understand it without that kind of stuff. Then how do you do, now it's easy for you to tell me about the third turning of the wheel. What are the disciples for the third turning of the wheel? Yeah. So that they can grasp the kind of emptiness taught in which turning of the wheel?
Second.
Right. Got it? Okay. So if you're the kind of student, you're Mahayana, you're really smart, you've got a good emptiness understanding. But to really understand emptiness in the deep way that Lord Buddha taught it in the second turning of the wheel, you need some kind of nice presentation. Hey, I didn't really mean that. You know, you have to split it. There's these three things, you know, Yong Drup, Shen Wang, Kun Ta. You know, and they need that kind of presentation, or else they don't get it. Okay? You alright? You got this grimace on your face.
Why would he teach it incorrectly so that they can understand it correctly?
Why, she said, why would he teach it incorrectly so they can understand it correctly? Listen to His Holiness teach in America, come on. You know? What people understand when he's finished is that they feel a little closer to His Holiness. Their understanding has come up another notch. And isn't that what we're talking about? Aren't we talking about tolerance in the end? Tolerance of different viewpoints. God knows if the guy that you're criticizing is some Buddha who's trying to bring those particular students up another notch by teaching them that yoga connects to your channel and your left ear, and then you can see emptiness is kind of a green light, you know? Okay? I mean, if this guy's crazy, worthless, no good, bad, maybe. But if it brings that student up a little bit, isn't that exactly what Lord Buddha was doing when he taught the first 3.5 schools of Buddhism? Okay? You know what I mean? It's the study of, you know, bringing students up a little higher. Okay? Would Buddha even say something which was directly incorrect to bring students up higher? Would he even say that a self nature to things did exist? Yeah, he would. And he did. Okay? Yeah. By the way, did he say that for the sake of people who are already Buddhists? No. You have to say no. Okay. He said it for some non-Buddhists, you know, who needed to hear that. Okay. Yeah. It'll be in your reading. It's at the end of your reading. But it's the fantastic, great, amazing, miraculous, best textbook writer in the universe, Kedub Dhammadarge, Bel Sambo. Okay. Yeah. Ah, good question. Is this presentation middleway or mine only? All this stuff I just said. Smells like middleway. Smells like middleway. Okay. By the way, I got to tell you the punchline or else I'll forget, and then you can ask me some more questions. So what's this got to do with saying that the third turning of the wheel was designed for students of all the yanas, of both the Hinayana and the Mahayana? Kedub Dhammadarge says, once you say that with a little help from the Bodhisattva, they can get the deeper form of emptiness, well then have they gotten the easier one already? Yes. By implication, yes. I mean, it's not stated, but okay, sure they did. So they got the Mahayana presentation and they got the Hinayana presentation. They've entered both yanas. That's what it really means. Okay? It doesn't mean people of every yana. It means those really smart dudes of the Mahayana who understand emptiness as taught by Mahayana and therefore also understand emptiness as taught by Hinayana, so you can call them guys who have entered all the yanas. Are they Hinayanas? No, but they already automatically get the Hinayana presentation because they already understand the Mahayana presentation. That's all. So Kedub Dhammadarge is helping us out. I mean, when I got to that part and I heard All vehicles in the third turning of the wheel, this is supposed to be the most difficult one. This is supposed to be the most advanced one. You got guys that jump from the first turning of the wheel to the third turning of the wheel without going to go, you know? I mean, okay, got it? Kind of. All right. Yeah.
In the mind-only school, I don't know that much about it, but I thought in the initial readings on it that it was really that everything is mind-centered. out of the mind itself. So peacefulness with self-existent things, the things that do exist from their own side of the mind only school, don't even really exist in the mind.
He said his initial impression of the mind only school, which mainly comes from the name mind only, right? And from bad explanations of mind only school in the West, is that they somehow believe everything is the mind or something like that. We're going to talk about that in the next class. Okay? Specifically, are external objects part of your mind or not? And is that what mind only means? And it's not. Okay? The word mind only has a, and what they believe about the mind and external objects existing or not is very, very delicate and very deep. And I'd rather spend a whole, and we got a beautiful explanation of it in India. I mean, the Lama went on like unbelievable about it. So I want to give it to you as a package next week. So I'll answer that. We'll defer that to next week, okay? To next class, which will be Thursday, I guess. Yeah, one more.
If, like you're saying that it, the Buddha taught, like what makes it incorrect? I mean, someone's understanding.
Oh, Rob says if it functions, then how can it be incorrect? I mean, you know, if you teach them something slightly wrong about emptiness to bring them up one notch, then if that teaching has brought them up one notch, it's a successful teaching, so it's a correct teaching. The teaching's correct, the subject matter is wrong. How's that? And it's helpful. Okay? Teaching correct, and the viewpoint is incorrect. But it helps them, it brings them up. Okay? Otherwise, everything would be Anuttara Yoga Tantra teaching, and no one would ever teach Abhidharma or anything like that. Okay? His Holiness would never give any other teaching except for Vajrayogini, you know? And, you know what I mean? It's, that's not the way it works, okay? All right, because you have to bring up people by stages. Okay. I wanted to give you another example. When he gets to the... Now I'll go back to the subject we were on, okay? We were talking about the first turning of the wheel. I said, is everything Lord Buddha taught during the first turning of the wheel the first turning of the wheel?
Yeah.
And he said, no. And then I said, well, give me an example. And you said, wear your robes nicely, you five. When he says you five, that's already a clue. What? It's got to be one of the first things he ever said, because disciple number six hasn't showed up yet. Okay? All right? We're ahead. We started with six students in the basement at 39th Street. Okay. So he said, you know, no. Now he says, what about the second turning of the wheel? Then they say, any teaching that Lord Buddha gave during the middle part of his career, right, which according to Kenneth Dhammadagi started like a year later, then... If he did not state, if he did not talk about what, then it's not the second turning of the wheel. Emptiness. Okay? Or to state it more correctly in this school, about the fact that nothing existed by definition. You know, that nothing existed by definition. Okay? If he wasn't like obsessing on that and talking about that clearly or directly during that particular teaching, we don't count it as the second turning of the wheel in the Drupadin. In the thing that the Bodhisattva figures out later. So, oh, Lord Buddha, I get it. You didn't mean what you said in the first two turns of the wheel. And you meant what you said in the third turn of the wheel, which is now. And Buddha goes, right. Okay? When we talk about the three turnings of the wheel from his point of view at that moment of his realization, then we're restricting the second turn of the wheel to statements that Lord Buddha made, those crazy statements from the mind-only school point of view. Nothing exists by definition. Pens don't have their own identity. There's no penness coming from this thing. It doesn't have any penness. I'm holding up a stick. If you happen to see a pen, it's coming from you. And there is no pen in my hand. It's a stick. It's a green and white stick. If you think there's any penness to that, you've got a problem. Okay? It's coming from you. It's not coming from here. Okay? If you believe that, you will never have another mental affliction. If your boss is an irritating person, you can kick one thing, one person, meaning you, okay, can never be angry at another person again, okay, which means that you all are stuck in the mind-only school, and it's useful to talk about this. You see, I mean, that's why we talk about mind-only, and that's a reason to talk about mind-only in middle way, okay, because in class from 7 to 9, you are defending Madhyamika, you know. At work, from 9 to 5, you know, you are holding mind-only school. My boss, that person who sits next to me and is so irritating, is irritating from their side. And the way to stop them is to argue with them, or to reason with them, or to fight with them, or to get the boss to hurt them, or get the other workers to believe my way. And then if somebody came along and said, no, the best way to get rid of this person, the best way to eliminate this person, is to be kind to them and never again have a bad thought about them. And they'll be out of there in 6 weeks. Transferred. Heart attack. Something. You know what I mean? Okay? It works. For God's sake, try it. This is Buddhism. This is real Buddhism, you know? You can have a world where everyone around you is the most sweet, incredible, amazing people, you know? You just gotta work on it the right way. Not the self-existent way. The self-existent way is to go to the boss and complain. The right way is to be so good to them that they get transferred. Okay? Right. Alright. Seriously, I'm not kidding. Nah. Sykes says you can punish them by being nice to them, but that's another thing. Okay. Third turning of the wheel. We're still on this last question, the same question, you know. Is everything that Lord Buddha taught during the final period of his career something that belongs to the third turning of the wheel? No. Why not? Because there's lots of teachings in which he doesn't make those fine distinctions. Okay, in this school, from this school's point of view, you don't get to be in the third turning of the wheel unless you are some kind of statement where Lord Buddha is making up with us. Hey, I didn't really mean it. These things do exist by definition. These things don't exist by definition. Okay, can you give me an example of such a teaching? Okay, it's on your homework. Say dulwa, dordu, rungtung. Sorry, Rungtun, Tu, Tarpa. Okay. On his deathbed, meaning just before he passed into final nirvana voluntarily, right? Meaning just before he withdrew his emanation on this planet, Lord Buddha suddenly pops out with a Dulwa teaching, okay? Dulwa means Vinaya, okay? Vow morality. For laymen and for ordained people. 8 sets of vows, 3 for lay people, 5 for ordained people. Okay? So dua, vinaya. Dordu means, we could say an abbreviation of the vinaya. Okay? Just before he leaves, he gives a final teaching on, called an abbreviated presentation of vowed morality. Okay? What's the subject matter? Rungtun. Okay? Rungtun means basically all of Lord Buddha's teachings on Vinaya can be divided into 3 categories. One is called Rungtun. Rungtun means okay to do. You should do it. Okay? Like he said, you have to do sojo. Okay? Like monks and nuns have to get together every 2 weeks and frankly, openly discuss their faults with each other. Okay, that's something you're supposed to do. Okay, now what's something you're not supposed to do? So it'd be like karpa of wearing lay clothes. Okay, not supposed to do it. All right, so that's the second category. And then there's rungtung, which means okay to do, but you don't have to do it. Okay, so certain kinds of monastic practices that you're allowed to do, but you don't have to do. So, like things in which you have a choice. Okay, and those are the 3. Rungtun means okay to do. Drakpa means he stated or he told people that's okay. Okay, so Rungtun to Drakpa means on his deathbed, Lord Buddha said, "Look, I taught you a lot of things about Vinaya. Now you ought to know the kind of things you're supposed to do and the kind of things you're not supposed to do. I taught you already. So carry on from there." You know, and the last words of the Vinaya Sutra are, you know, now apply that to your times and your country and your culture. What I taught you about Vinaya. Now you take those rules and you apply it to your own culture and that's called Rungtun. It's a very famous teaching at the end of the Vinaya Sutra. Okay? And it's very important for the future of monasticism and nunisticism in the West. Okay, you have to apply it. You have to apply it to your milieu. Okay. Okay. Anyway, that was the last Vinaya teaching he gave. Was that spoken in the final period of his life? Yes. I mean, he purposely chooses what? One that he spoke on his deathbed. Okay, it's got to be the final period. Okay, it's not like we're not talking the last year or the last month. We're talking, you know, last few hours. You know. Is it the final turning of the wheel according to my noise school? No. Why not?
It doesn't have
He didn't make fine distinctions. He wasn't like, oh, that doesn't exist by definition, that doesn't exist by definition. Okay? All right? So it doesn't qualify. In this school, it's the third turning of the wheel. In this sutra, it's the third turning of the wheel. By the way, I asked Rinpoche a question that I wasn't sure about, and I fudged it, okay? Let's go to the easy one. In the mind-only school, is the first turning of the wheel figurative or literal? In the mind-only school, is the first turning of the wheel figurative or literal? Well, let's say with regard to this sutra, he taught that everything exists by definition. Was he being literal? I mean, don't forget, main point of the first turning of the wheel, from the mind-only point of view, he said your heaps, the four, everything exists by definition. Was he figurative? It's figurative. It's a blanket statement. It's wrong. Okay? You know, when he says nothing exists, I'm sorry, everything exists by definition, it's got to be figurative. He can't be telling the whole truth. Okay? Everybody knows some things do and some things don't exist by definition. So in the first turning of the wheel must be, according to the mind-only school, figurative. Okay. Second turning of the wheel, nothing exists by definition. Figurative, in this school. Okay. Last turning of the wheel, hey, I was just kidding, you got to divide it.
Literal.
Okay. Now, switch to midway school. Good. First turning of the wheel. Figurative for what reason? Louder. Yeah, it's not clearly, directly presenting the subject of emptiness. That's what it means in the middle way school to be figurative or literal. Don't forget, we not only shift meanings about emptiness, we shift criteria for whether it's figurative or literal. It's no longer, can you take it on face value? It's no longer, is he making those distinctions? It's, is he talking about emptiness? Okay. And the first turn of the wheel, he doesn't. Clearly, directly. Does he mention it? Yes. Why? Because he mentions the four Arya truths, and it's one of the four Arya truths. Which one? In cessation. In the middle of sensation somewhere, he mentions the aspect of Dakmepa, okay? Selflessness. Okay. Second turning of the wheel. Mind only, oh sorry, middle way school, figurative or literal?
Literal,
because he just smeared emptiness all over the place. Hard sutra, diamond cutter sutra, Prajnaparamita sutras, okay? Again, obviously literal. Now the one I wasn't sure about, and the one I just kind of avoided last class, is the third one. Does he talk about emptiness or not?
Not clearly.
Not clearly, you can say, yeah. Okay, I mean, Rinpoche said, yeah, it's not clear. And it's not exact. You know, although he's making distinctions and saying, I meant this emptiness and I didn't make that. To me, I wasn't sure, because it seems like he's talking about emptiness a lot. But Rinpoche said, no, it doesn't count. Okay. Okay, so the accepted Madhyamika viewpoint is that, yeah, third turn of the wheel is figurative. Okay. And I think Aura made a beautiful chart in which he put all those, the time, the place, the subject matter, the viewpoint, the disciples, and the view, whether it's figurative or literal to the Minoy school and Minoy school. Did you finish it? I don't know. Did you print that? Yeah? Next class or this class? This class? You'll get it next class. Anyway, it's a big chart, and it's really cool. Tibetan and English, and I think it's almost done. Okay. Last thing before the break, okay? We'll take a break. There's a section now that Jetsun Kapa turns to. He says, why did Buddha go through all this hassle? It's kind of your question, okay? You know, why go through all the trouble of stating one thing and then stating the opposite and then stating that neither one was good? Okay, I mean, what's the point? You know, what's the point of doing that? What's the point of going through the exercise of trying to decide which turnings of the wheel are literal and which are figurative? What's the point of the sutra? You know, what's the sutra trying to get? What's it trying to help us, right? All sutras, part of the definition of a sutra is to help the student, you know. So what's he trying to do for us? What's Buddha trying to help us with? You know, what's the point of setting out three different stages of your teaching and then ripping them apart and saying, this is what I meant and this is what I didn't mean it, you know. Robin says try and remove our misconceptions. And here's the standard answer for your homework, okay? I mean, that's actually correct. And you've seen that's what they're doing, right? Especially mind only. We talk big, we talk Madhyamika. Our viewpoint at work is mind only. Proof is you get mental afflictions. You couldn't be holding a Madhyamika viewpoint of your boss or of your fellow worker and still be angry at them. You must be holding a mind-only viewpoint. Okay? Changing Shenwang. Okay? Self-existent Shenwang. Bad from its own side. Okay? Not because of my crummy karma, which I'm now perpetuating very nicely. Okay? Okay. Three goals that Lord Buddha had in mind when he taught that sutra that the mind-only school lacks so much. Okay? When he ripped apart his own teaching. Okay? First goal. Lord Buddha wanted us to learn not to take his two blanket statements literally. So it's a negative kind of goal. Okay? First one is kind of negative. What two blanket statements? Yeah, first and second turning wheels. Everything exists by definition, or nothing exists by definition. Okay, he wanted us to learn not to take either of those two blanket statements literally. That was goal number one. Yeah. Has to be my only goal. Okay, second goal is a positive goal. He wanted us to understand that of those three groups, which is what? Gun, Dak, Shen, Wang, Yong, Du. Okay? Gun, Dak meaning? Constructs, things you imagine. Okay? Shen, Wang meaning? All changing things, all dependent things. Yong, Du meaning? Emptiness, the mind-only version of emptiness. Okay? That by dividing things into those three and saying, he wanted us to understand, hey, imaginary things don't exist from their own side by definition. They don't have their own identity. You lend them their identity. By willpower, wishing, imagination. Okay? But hey, the other two things, pens and emptiness, oh, they got their own identity. They exist from their own side. Okay? He wanted us to be able to make this distinction. This stuff doesn't exist by definition. This stuff does. Okay? This one category doesn't. These two categories do exist by definition. He wanted to enlighten us. Okay, you're not going to ask me which school I'm talking about now, right? It's obviously a mind-only, propagandist. Okay? He wanted to help us out, you know? Some things exist by definition, some don't. He wanted us to understand that. Thank you, Lord Buddha, for finally clearing it up. Okay? Which according to the Middle Way School is BS, you know? Okay, come on. Okay, third one. He wanted to give us a really cool way of understanding emptiness. A really cool way. With what? I mean, that teaching in that sutra presents three different categories. What are they? Shenwang? Sorry, Gunda Shenwang Yondu, okay? What? Imaginary things, dependent things, and emptiness in the mind-only 31 flavor version, okay? That's a really cool way to understand emptiness. Get it? That's why he taught it. Okay? That's why he went through all this stuff. It's such a cool way to understand emptiness. Why? First of all, you take the thing you want to establish emptiness about, which is a Shenwang. Okay? So the Shenwang part of the three is to help us to choose something to talk about its emptiness. Okay, why? How about a pen, a dependent thing? Okay, a Shenwang. Then you say, guess what? It doesn't have a certain kind of kuntak. Beautiful answer. Okay? By the way, the root text and Jetsun Kapa don't often say a certain kind of kuntak. It just says kuntaks. But you know, there's good kuntaks and bad kuntaks. Okay? What's a good kuntaks? Yeah, when your parents thought of you as, you know, Robin. That's a kuntak, but that's okay. No problem there. Okay? But when I think of you as a Robin that exists independent of me, of my mind, a separate karmic seed is producing you and another one is producing my mind, then I'm going to get into problems. That idea about Robin doesn't exist. Okay? And the fact that it doesn't exist on you is your Yongdu. Okay? This is a cool way of understanding emptiness. The emptiness of Robin means that the idea that Robin is coming from some separate outside thing and not from my mind, okay? Or not from my own karma, is false. And the fact that that doesn't apply, that's a kuntak which is false. And she's a Shenwang. And the fact that that's not true about her is her yungdra. It's her emptiness. It's so cool. It's such a cool system for understanding the emptiness of anything. Brilliant. Third goal of the sutra. Okay. Third reason why Lord Buddha goes into all this Chang'e stuff. Okay. The third reason why he has to pull out of his bag of teachings the idea of these three attributes. Okay. Why? Because they're so cool for understanding emptiness. Okay. In general, they're pretty correct also. I mean, you know, if you look at them the right way, they can be okay. Okay. According to Middle Way School. Okay. According to Minor Way School, they're brilliant already. Okay. Alright? So the third goal of Lord Buddha going through this exercise of trying to reinterpret his own teachings by bringing up these three categories is that it's a very cool way to understand the emptiness of anything, you know. You're obviously, after you've had that teaching about emptiness, you're not going to go around saying that emptiness is watching your mind or watching the luminous nature of your mind flow by or something like that. It has nothing to do with what we're talking about, okay? So obviously it's a very valuable teaching to give somebody. Hey, think of it in these three terms. The fact that it doesn't, that a self-existent object, a kundak, has nothing to do with this changing thing, a shenwang, is what its emptiness means. Yongdu. And that's a very cool way for understanding the emptiness of anything. Okay? And then you're not going to get into these wrong ideas like emptiness is some black hole in the middle of your head or something like that. Okay? Alright? Okay, yeah. Those three things. Okay. Yeah, those three things. Okay, what Jetsun Kab is trying to clarify for us, why does the Buddha go through this exercise? I mean, why doesn't he just come out and say everything's empty, you know? Why does he get up and bring up these three stupid things? And why does he keep going back and rehashing his three turning the wheel? And what does he bring up this little figurative stuff for? Well, it has those three goals. I don't want you to take everything I said as a blanket statement. Negative goal. Positive goal. I want you to understand that some things exist by definition and some things don't. This is my only goal. Okay. And then thirdly, I want to give you a really cool way of understanding emptiness by giving you these three things. You know, changing things, dependent things, constructs, and then totality or emptiness. Okay, that's all. One last question, you get some refreshments.
You can use that three-way description of emptiness and to turn into a middle-way school analysis by saying, once you take away the kuntak of pen, then you have just a kuntak of cylinder and blue, and you take away those kuntaks, and you just keep going infinitely.
Yeah, Mark said you can use the presentation of the three attributes to explain Madhyamika also. Yes. Does Madhyamika accept the three attributes? Yeah. Do they say it's a useful way to understand emptiness? Yeah. So what's the difference between them and the Minor Way School? Oh, they don't need this Bodhisattva to come out and ask a question about it. They get it right away. Okay? No, that's actually part of the definition. Yeah, you can say that all the schools accept the idea of those three attributes. They have different ideas about what it means. And they interpret it in different ways. But Mark's right, and in fact it's the case, that if you went and asked an Abhidharmist, or a Sutrist, or a Minor Way School, or a Sautrantika, or Svatantrika, or Prasangika. You ask them all, do you like this idea of three attributes? They say, yeah, it's kind of cool. What's it mean? And then each of them would go off onto his own spiel, and they'd be different. Okay? But they'd all say it's a useful way to think. Okay? Okay, I think we'll take a break, and I promised you some kind of discussion about Lord Buddha making some crazy statements to non-Buddhists about saying self-nature does exist. Okay? He did say that. He even went that far. Now, what did he mean? Okay, we'll talk about that after a commercial break. Okay. Everybody pray tomorrow at work that they're having a board meeting out in Arizona about the property that we're trying to grub off of this rancher. So, I mean this sponsor. And Jerry Dixon, 50,000 acres. I mean... No, that's what his ranch is. So we're just asking for a tiny little couple of acres. And then if it works out, then everybody has to come out and build an adobe retreat place. Okay. All right. Okay. We were talking about... No, but please, seriously, do pray for tomorrow. Okay. We were talking about... Lord Buddha did, in a very generous day, you know, for the sake of some people who he wanted to attract into Buddhism. You know, they probably asked him, you know, you've been saying a lot of radical stuff about self not existing. Did you really mean that? And he probably said something like, no, I didn't at all. Of course there's a self. You know, of course you have some self-existent self about you. Okay. And then they said, well, what is that? And then he went off into a thing called Deshin Shepe Nyingbo. Say Deshin
Shepe
Nyingbo.
Deshin
Shepe
Nyingbo.
So at some point in Tibet, in the time of Dzogchen Kapa, there were Tibetans who started to get so radical, they said, all three turnings of the wheel are literal. You have to accept the subject matter of all three turnings of the wheel. Okay? You get to some point, if you argue the mind-only school the wrong way, that you have to accept all three of them as being literal. Okay? And this was a popular viewpoint among certain schools in Tibet, that all three turnings of the wheel were literal. And that when Lord Buddha specifically said that you did have a self nature of yourself. By the way, do you have a self?
Yes.
Of course you do. Use Ramen, use, you know. He said literal or figurative. I'm speaking literally, okay? Yeah, of course you have a self. You know, you're Bruno Donato, you know, you're you. Of course you're you, okay? Michael Roach is standing up here giving a talk, okay? He exists. There's a self that exists and there's a self that doesn't exist. You got to get used to that. What's the self that doesn't exist about Michael Roach? The one that's not coming from your karmic projection. Well, where is he? He don't exist. All right? If you like me, that's your problem. If you don't like me, that's your problem. Okay? If you see something nice, you collected some good karma. Congratulations. You know, if you see something you don't like, that's your problem. I'm sorry that you did that. You know what I mean? But I myself have no nature. The proof of that is that 50 different people have 50 different interpretations of what I'm saying and who I am. You know what I mean? So that would be the non-existent Michael Roach. That's what we mean when you say no self, and that kind of no self applies to every other object in the universe. Okay? Now these guys got it wrong, and they say, Lord Buddha was speaking literally when he said that we had a self, and there is a self nature of me. And what he was talking about, specifically, you know, the other schools of Tibetan Buddhism said, come on, you know, tell me what he was talking about then. You know, when Lord Buddha is trying to attract non-Buddhists, and he says, yeah, you do have a self nature, that comes from yourself, you know, that stands out there all by itself. Okay? Then what on earth do you think he was talking about? Okay? This is, Dzogchen Kapa is criticizing some other schools. Dzogchen Kapa is very discreet. Why? He doesn't mention any names. Okay? But you know who you are. Okay? No, I mean, that was his style. And later commentaries identify the speakers, which is the Jonamba school. It is a particular school of Buddhism in Tibet that had some strange ideas. Jonamba was a brilliant scholar who according to Dzogchen Kapa, stretched things a little too far. Okay, so here's another idea. They say the thing Lord Buddha was talking about in the first turning of the wheel, which seems to be the least literal thing he ever said, like the thing you'd want to say was figurative when he said, yes, you do have a self nature. Definitely. They say he was speaking literally, and he was talking about that little Buddha inside of you. Okay? Every person has a little Buddha inside of them. You know? Like there's already a Buddha under your skin. Okay? And you just have to peel off all of those delusions, and you'll see yourself as the Buddha, because you already are. Okay? I mean, they misinterpret a teaching of the Buddha. Okay? The Buddha did give a teaching called Buddha nature. Does it mean that you are already a Buddha, and you just have to reveal or unveil something, and you'll find your little Buddha in there? You know, this is a very popular teaching. I've seen it. I've read books on it. You know, I've heard it expressed. And Lord Buddha never said that. He never meant that. He talked about a Buddha nature. It doesn't mean that you're already a Buddha. It would not have taken Lord Buddha 75,000 plus 76,000 plus 77,000 times 10 to the 60th power eons to achieve Buddhahood if it was just a matter of unveiling this little Buddha inside of you. Okay? No, you have to develop it. You have to train yourself. You have to practice. Okay? There is no little Buddha sitting inside of you. Does that mean you don't have a Buddha nature? No, it doesn't mean that. You do have a Buddha nature. What does Buddha nature really mean? Sugata Garbha. Okay? Buddha nature. Very simple. What is it? The emptiness of your mind. When you get to Buddhahood, there's only one part of you that's still going to be the same. I hope our minds won't be the same. I hope my body's not the same. Okay? Alright? But the emptiness of my mind I can carry all the way to Buddhahood. And I will. Okay? And it's great. Why? It's the capacity for me to become an enlightened being. Okay? If my mind was not empty, if my mind existed in this dirty, mentally afflicted, angry, jealous, etc. way, from its own sign, I'd be stuck with it forever. If it was like a pen that existed from its own sign, I could never remove my mental afflictions. But since it's empty, meaning since it's a projection of my karma, then if I clean up my karmic act, I'll start seeing my mind as better and better. Like Arya's mind, and then Arhat's mind, and then enlightened being's mind. Is it because I'm training my mind or something like that? No. It's because I'm collecting virtue at such a rate that it forces me to see my mind a different way. And Arhats, as the Diamond Cutter Sutra says, are just people who are being forced or compelled by their karma to see their mind as totally pure. Okay? So that's the real way to do it. It's the same as getting rid of people at work. Same concept. You don't do it by some external self-existent process. You change your karma, you do your book, and then you're forced to see your mind as a sweeter place to be in. Okay? Because you're projecting different karma things onto your mind. Okay, so that's... And if your mind wasn't a blank screen, you couldn't do that. So the best thing about you, and in fact the only enlightened part of you, so-called, you know, quote enlightened, is the fact that your mind is empty. And that's the potential for you to become an enlightened being. If your mind wasn't blank, in a sense, you'd be in trouble. You know, if all those mental afflictions were a natural part of your mind and were not your projections, then you'd be in big trouble. Then you couldn't get rid of them because there wouldn't be any place to put new projections. Okay? So your mind is blank, your mind is empty, and that's why you can become a Buddha. This is your potential. This is your Buddha nature. Okay? That's all Lord Buddha meant. He never said there's a little Buddha guy somewhere down near your appendix, and, you know, you just have to reveal your true nature or something like that. Your true nature is mentally afflicted. Your true nature is to misperceive the world every single second of your existence. That's your true nature, okay? It's changeable. Why? Because your mind is empty. That you have a Buddha nature. And will that be the same when you become an enlightened being? Yeah. Minds of enlightened beings are just as empty as minds of non-enlightened beings. Okay? In fact, that's the only piece of you that's going to be left over when you get to enlightenment. So, you know, enjoy it. You have some little piece of your enlightenment with you. Okay? That's all that that means. So again, Jethun Kapa is not only... And by the way, when we got taught this in Saramay, the teacher spent a whole, I don't know, like an hour or 2 hours on this point, you know? And he said, and then at the end he said, I'm concentrating on this point, which is a minor... mention in Jetsun Kapa's text in your reading. You might even skip it if you don't read it carefully. He says, I'm concentrating on it because I've heard that in the West people are teaching this. You know, and I want to make sure that you understand that. That's not what Buddha nature means. Okay? Here's the word for Buddha nature. We'll go on to the last subject. Is that Tangdun or Ngedun? Figurative or literal statement? I don't know. Let's see. Actually, because of the question, I told you he saved you 15 minutes. Okay, he did. Okay, last thing on your homework that I didn't cover is... Oh, that's too bad. Okay, there you go. Buddha nature, the word for Buddha nature. So on your homework when it says... By the way, everything I put up on the screen is on your homework in case you didn't notice yet. Okay. Say Deshin, Shekpe, Ningbo. Deshin, Shekpe, Ningbo. Deshin means like that. tata in Sanskrit. Tata, like that. Shekla means gone. Gata in Sanskrit. Tathagata. Tathagata. Okay, gone like that. Gone that way. Gone what way? Gone to enlightenment. Okay, gone that way. Okay, those who are gone that way. It's a synonym for a Buddha. Okay. Ningbo means the essence of the heart. Okay, and this is a code word for Buddha nature. Okay. So yeah, Buddha did talk to people about some kind of essence, essential nature in their being. He was not talking about a self nature of the person. He was not being literal in the first turning of the wheel. You're wrong if you think all three turnings of the wheel are literal. Okay? That's all. He was talking about the emptiness of your mind, your Buddha nature. That's all. He wasn't talking about some permanent, self-standing, from its own side, self. Okay? Wasn't talking about that. So don't get it messed up. Okay? Yeah. Yeah, what they call Atman in Sanskrit. Okay? All right, last thing. Where is that? So, I threw into your reading 25 torturous pages of dialectic on these subjects. They're very beautiful. If you have time, go through them. Okay? All the questions that came up in your mind naturally during this class are treated there. Because that's how they write those books. They're brilliant, you know. They actually anticipate the questions that come up in your mind, and then they argue them like you argue them in your own mind, okay? And they're very beautiful. To me, they're the most beautiful kind of Buddhist literature. You know, wrong ideas are brought up by this guy over here, and this guy over here argues, and then finally they decide, and then somewhere in the middle they give you the straight party line, okay? But what's cool is you don't learn the straight party line until you've heard all these arguments, okay? Like, 10 people have come and made very sophisticated arguments about Buddha nature, for example, that are slightly wrong. And you've gotten to see the arguments develop and fold, unfold, and then by the time they finish arguing, you already understand what Buddha nature is very beautifully, okay? And that's the style in which these books are written. Comes a point where Kedab Tarma Dargye stops torturing you with dialectic. He says, okay, look, you want to know what the real thing is? I'll tell you. Okay? And he gives a definition of the first turning of the wheel, for example. That's about this long. Okay? I mean, this has to be a technical definition that you could defend in the debate ground against 1,000 other monks. You better cover every single thing that someone might argue about. Okay? Technical definitions for the debate ground tend to be like 10 lines long. Okay? Then he says, you know what? You don't even need that technical definition. I'll give you a new one for the first turning of the wheel. And he gives one little sentence. It's very cool, okay? I thought it'd be nice. And that's the last thing for tonight.
Literally?
Literally. Definition of the first turning of the wheel. Kedab Tenpa Dargye. The ultimate definition. Okay, say. Korlo.
Korlo.
Sumbo.
Sumbo.
Karundu.
Kyurpe.
Tegmengi.
Tegmengi.
Do. One more time. Korlo.
Korlo.
Sumbo.
Sumbo.
Karundu.
Kyurpe.
Tegmengi.
Tegmengi.
Do. This is the definition of the first turning of the wheel. Okay. Korlo Sumbo means, Korlo means turning of the wheel. And I know you still remember the meaning of turning of the wheel, right? The teacher turns the turning of the wheel of the Dharma, the physical Dharma, meaning the teacher's speech or the teacher's writing. And that turns a corresponding wheel of realizations in the student's heart. And that's how you turn the turning of the wheel, okay? And that presentation comes partly from the last pages of the Abhidhamma Kosha, okay? So Korlo Sumbo means the three turnings of the wheel. Sumbo means all three. Kangrun to Gyurpa means any one. We can say which belongs to anyone. Okay? Which belongs to anyone. Tekmen means Hinayana, lower way. Lower way. Do means sutra. How's this for a definition of the first turning of the wheel? Ready? a sutra of the lower way that belongs to any three of the turnings of the wheel. Say again? That's his definition. That's the ultimate definition, okay? Now, I will ask you, how's that for definition? A sutra of the lower way that belongs to any one of the three turnings of the wheel is the definition of the first turning of the wheel. Nice? How can you... It's circular. It's circular. How can you define a turning of the wheel by referring to other turnings of the wheel? That's like saying the guy in the first seat is the guy that is sitting in any one of the three seats. No, it is. It's exactly the same thing. Think about it. The guy in the first seat is the guy sitting in any one of the guy sitting in the first three seats. Or something like that. It doesn't make sense, you see? How can you define the first turning of the wheel as being, you know, something which belongs to the other three, any one of the other three? Any one, you know, meaning that maybe it might belong to the second, might belong to the third.
If the first thing happened,
I think what you have to say is you have to interpret this turning of the wheel as meaning what? Any one of the three periods. Historical periods. You see what I mean? If you read it that way, does it work? How about we read it that way? The first turning of the wheel consists of all the Hinayana Sutras ever spoken in any of the three periods of the Buddha's life. You know, and you take it to be the historical turning of the wheel, as opposed to the turning of the wheel as described in the Mind-Only School Sutra, or something like that. Okay, you got to be careful. I think you got to read it that way. And one more point. Does lower way mean Hinayana? Not really here, okay? Is it dissing all the people who practice Theravada? No. Okay? What are they talking about? Any sutra which expresses more basic or more elementary ideas about emptiness, okay? Any sutra like that, no matter when it was spoken, no matter which of the three great convocations, no matter which of the three parts of the Buddha's life, doesn't matter. That is a first turning of the wheel. That's the first turning of the wheel. Okay. Sorry? Yeah, the first turning of the wheel consists of all the teachings that Buddha ever gave throughout his lifetime. That expresses a more simple idea of emptiness, a modified version of emptiness that's a little simpler for people to understand. That's what we call the first turning of the wheel. Then, as you'll read in his reading, you could define second turning of the wheel as any Mahayana sutra or any teaching that Lord Buddha gave. What would you say? In which he taught emptiness, but he taught it for the sake of people who didn't understand, who could understand the meaning of emptiness without getting it rehashed or reinterpreted by some book like that one where the Bodhisattva asked the question. And then you can say the third turning of the wheel is, you know, any teaching which the Buddha gave for Mahayana people who needed that kind of rehash to understand emptiness as it was taught in the second turning of the wheel. Okay? Because they couldn't get it. Comfortable? Okay? And that's a simple presentation of how he presents the three turns of the wheel. Is it comfortable? Got it? Okay. And now we're down to the end of the class, and we're down to the main point of interpretation. And in fact, next class we're going to go on to a totally different subject. We have just crossed a major turning point in Jetsun Kapa's text. He's done with the sutra. He's going to go on to a few famous mind-only school thinkers of ancient India and how they use the sutra to invent the mind-only school, or to present the mind-only school. Who's going to be the main culprit? Master Asanga. Okay? Master Asanga. Is Master Asanga presenting his own viewpoints? No, you'll see he's reporting mind-only school viewpoints. Okay? That's an important point. So before he goes on to that, the big point here is this. Get it? The definition of the second turning of the wheel the third turning of the wheel is where Lord Buddha has to, what do you call it? He has to, it's not a clarification. He's actually making up something which is not correct, which is not true. to help somebody who couldn't get emptiness the first time when he taught it back on Vulture's Peak. Okay? He has to come up with these three attributes, and he has to start saying, I didn't mean it in that case, I did mean it in this case. He's There must be a word in English. He's rewriting history or something. What do you call it? I don't know, anyway. He's repackaging it. Okay? For people who couldn't get it the first time. When was the first time? On Vulture's Peak in the second turning of the wheel. He's repackaging it in a different... Now he splits that deodorant into three different types. You know, he makes a new box. He says, okay, get it now, you know? Okay, like that. Yeah.
Who doesn't get it?
No, the Bodhisattva gets it. Drupadun. Hey, oh, I'm good. You didn't mean it. The second one, you mean it. Oh, yeah, he's still... Yeah. No, he doesn't get it. As long as he's still stuck in Minoli school, he doesn't get it. But at least he reached Minoli school. You see what I mean? That was the whole point. Getting up to Minoli school. We'll get to Madhyamika tomorrow. You know? Where was he before that? He wasn't even up to Minoli school yet. Okay? Yeah? Sorry? Oh, equivocating, in a way. Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. Remember, the whole sutra started out by saying what? I mean, the whole Jetsun Kapa started out by quoting a sutra that says, look, Buddha uses a billion different arguments for emptiness, and he uses tapsul. Tapsul meaning sneaky ways to get them to understand something. Okay? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. He says, why is the Bodhisattva asking a question? Because it seems contradictory. Because when you reach the first Bodhisattva Bhumi, you must have, by definition, perceived emptiness directly. It is true that when you reach the first Bodhisattva Bhumi, you do reach it by seeing emptiness directly and by having bodhicitta in your heart. So if you see emptiness directly and don't have bodhicitta in your heart, you just become a Hinayana Arya. Okay? If you see emptiness directly and do have bodhicitta in your heart, you become an Arya, you become two of the three jewels on that moment, and then incidentally you become a Bodhisattva on the first Bodhisattva Bhumi. That's when the Bhumis begin. But you become a Bodhisattva long before that, okay? Two steps before that, way before that. There's a big difference between a Bodhisattva Arya and a Bodhisattva non-Arya, okay? Meaning a Bodhisattva who's seen emptiness directly and who hasn't seen emptiness directly. So you can be a Bodhisattva long before you reach the first Bodhisattva Bhumi, okay? And actually millions of years, or thousands of years before, okay? Or something like that, okay? Becoming a Bodhisattva only requires having bodhicitta. Then you get to be a Bodhisattva. It's soglam, Mahayana soglam, path of accumulation. And then much later you achieve path of seeing and start the Bhumis, okay? Like that. Yeah, one more question. Yeah, he says, well, even if he already was a Bodhisattva Arya, maybe he's asking it just for the benefit of others, yeah. And most times in the commentaries, you'll see somebody say, he's actually Avalokiteshvara. He's actually a tantric deity already, as we saw in the Diamond Cutter Sutra. So Buddha is already a tantric deity. And he's just playing fall guy for the Buddha. And you see it in the monastery all the time. The very humble, brilliant, older Geshes will come into a talk of 1,000 monks and debate and make some small mistake in their presentation to a new Geshe and let them beat him. But it takes them 3 hours, you know. And at the end they say, oh man, you're so smart, you know, I never thought of it. You know, and then actually they're just trying to help everybody else. And then they sit down like, you know, and put their head down and act like they got beaten, you know what I mean? But it's really, they're just doing it for everybody else, and they do that, you know. Okay. I had some other point. What was that? Oh. So that's all. The main point being, to me, the beauty of Caitanya Dhammadagadhara is that he's pointing out that the Buddha is repackaging his presentation of emptiness according to the audience. Okay, and you're going to have to do that too. You're living in a country where people have no idea of emptiness. If they ever heard the word, they think it means some kind of black hole, or they've heard 10 wrong explanations of it, from ridiculous to pretty cool. And you're going to have to be able to make your presentation, you know, fitting the audience, you know. And in fact, Not to attempt to fit your explanation of emptiness to your audience is breaking a bodhisattva vow. Okay. If they're not ready for a certain one, you have to give them a mind-only version or something like that. Okay. And that. What should we say? Jetsun Kapa, in his commentary to that bodhisattva vow, says, if you think you're giving them one that fits them and it turns out that you didn't, do you still break the vow? No. Okay. It's to your best knowledge. You judge your audience. To the best of your knowledge, you judge your audience and you give them a presentation of emptiness. Now, some Westerners say, therefore I should never teach emptiness to anybody. And that's not correct either. You must. You have to. Let's try. Okay. I would say a good judge of whether or not you're presenting it in a responsible way and in a correct way is, does it immediately link to virtue and non-virtue? Do you immediately start talking about emptiness means that things are determined by the karma, which, you know, by the projections which are forced on you by your karma? And then you immediately start talking about compassion and good deeds and stuff like that. If someone talks about emptiness for more than 5 minutes and doesn't bring up the link between that and your projections forced on you by your morality, then there's a problem. You know? Then I think the audience is in trouble of misunderstanding emptiness. You see what I mean? You have to bring up, as soon as you bring up emptiness, you better get to karma in 5 minutes. As soon as you bring up karma, you better bring up emptiness in 5 minutes. Okay? Otherwise it doesn't tie together. That's why Lord Buddha spent 25 years teaching one, 25 years teaching the other. That's why the Kangyur divides pretty equally into morality and emptiness. Okay? Because they go together. Alright? Alright, we'll do some closing prayer. Okay?
been listening to What the Buddha Really Meant with Geshe Michael Roach, presented by the Asian Classics Institute. The Asian Classics Institute is dedicated to preserving the pure teachings and practice of Buddhism. For a listing of other topics available, write to the Asian Classics Institute, P.O. Box 20373, New York, New York, 10009, or call 212-475-7752.